Thanks for allowing me into your home, your long-haul truck, RV, camper, taxi, your parents' well-appointed basement with the simulated wood paneling, electric fireplace, and the painting of dogs playing poker. Your loft, that greasy spoon just off the interstate, and your cabin in the woods. Welcome to Coast AM, the very best in late-night talk radio. I'm Richard Serrett. And tonight, this morning, we're coming to you live from Old Thornhill Village, just north of Toronto. Happy Father's Day to all the dads. You know, fathers are more important than ever. Good, strong, kind, loving dads. Dads that stick around and protect their families and provide for their families and provide love and discipline and guidance. Fathers who take time to take their children to the park or a ball game or fishing or camping. So, if you've got one, be good to him today. And if yours is no longer on this earthly plane, remember him, honor him. Hold on to the good memories. Try and let the rest of it go. And if you're new at fatherhood, wondering what kind of father you should be the kind of dad you needed when you were a kid. Back in August of 1976, my father and mother drove my brother and sisters and I out east, about 1,100 miles to Cavendish Beach in Prince Edward Island. It would be our first experience seeing the Atlantic Ocean, swimming in the Atlantic Ocean. I was 12. And for the car trip, I chose to read one of the previous summer's hottest titles by Peter Benchley. You guessed it, Jaws. So the family hit the beach. My parents and siblings headed straight for the water. I sat back on a beach towel. My parents tried to coax me into the water, but I'd have none of it. Didn't they know? Didn't they understand most shark attacks occur in just 3 feet of water, I wondered? Five of us had traveled 1,100 miles over about 3 days of driving, and I wouldn't dip so much as a toe in the Atlantic Ocean. My parents soon realized that book was responsible for practically ruining my summer vacation, except it hadn't. I loved that book. Now, I still have an irrational fear of sharks, but I loved that book. Now, here I am in my 50s. I feel the same way about another author who spins riveting, frightening tales about huge, flesh-eating creatures that lurk in the murky depths of the world's oceans and the murky depths of our imaginations. Max Hawthorne is known as the Prince of Paleofiction, and his series of books called Chronos Rising, about a colossal super predator that existed 65 million years ago, but somehow survived several extinction events, reemerged from its lair, and then began terrorizing and feeding upon the residents of a fishing village. It's the kind of storytelling that keeps you coming back for more, a real page-turner, but probably not great for the tourist season at coastal resorts. While the prehistoric creature from Chronos Rising is fictional, the truth is the deepest areas of the world's oceans and seas are practically unexplored. We don't really know what lurks beneath. We don't really know what's down there, what enormous living thing might be down there. And of course, we have countless legends of sea serpents and squids so large they're capable of taking down an entire ship, and sharks the size of school buses. Could such legends be true? Hawthorne has just published a new book on the subject called Monsters and Marine Mysteries, which just might be more frightening than the Chronos Rising series, because this collection of encounters with enormous sea creatures is nonfiction. It includes an extensive list of true tales of marine cryptids, some truly terrifying encounters, and even run-ins with real flesh and blood monsters. Max is standing by and will be here for hours one and two. You've read the stories about sea monsters and other creatures. Now it's time for the evidence. Nikola Tesla said if you want to understand the secrets of the universe, you need to think in terms of energy, frequency, and vibration. Vibration, sound. Quantum mechanics suggests everything, I mean everything, is all comprised of the same stuff. But that stuff simply manifests at different levels of vibration. We're going to talk about vibration in the second half, and sound, and music. Our bodies and minds react differently to the unrelenting noise of a jackhammer than to a trickle of water in a creek. In other words, some sounds simply make us feel better than others. Whether our conscious minds are paying attention or not, our bodies take their cues from these sounds and rhythms, knowing when to get energized and when to slow down. Now, a growing body of research suggests that when used in a directed way, sound can also help us reduce stress, create a deep sense of well-being, and even promote healing. From playing Bach in the nursery to yogic chanting in the oncologist's office, sound therapy is gaining popularity as both a preventative medicine and as a complement to more traditional treatments. Good for both the mind and the body, it has been shown to help lift depression, clear sinuses, help cancer patients recover more quickly from chemotherapy. Christina Grozek is a certified vibrational sound therapist, integrated health coach, yoga and meditation teacher, polarity practitioner, energy balancing guide, past life regressionist, and Reiki master, and the producer of a new film on this subject called Going Om. Om is said to be the sound of the creation of the universe. This whole world, says one ancient text, is nothing but Om. Om is the symbol of the highest vibration, the purest energy, that which connects everything in existence. By chanting Om, the mind becomes present. We'll all attempt to go Om in the second half of tonight's vibration, I mean transmission. Welcome to the Audio Imaginarium. Come on in, weary traveler, hang your cloak on a peg, grab a stool, and come gather around the fire. There are stories to be told, and you are among friends. I'm Richard Serrett, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Why don't you stay a while? Known as the Prince of Paleo Fiction, Max Hawthorne was born in Brooklyn and attended school in Philadelphia, where he graduated from the University of the Arts. He's the author of the award-winning Kronos Rising novel series. In addition to being a best-selling indie novelist, he's an amateur paleontologist, a blog talk radio host, a voting member of the Authors Guild, an IGFA world record-holding angler, and an avid sportsman and conservationist. His hobbies include archery, fishing, boating, boxing, and the collection of fossils and antiquities. He lives in the greater Northeast with his wife, daughter, and an enormous Siberian forest cat who, when he's not stalking Max's toes, sleeps on his desk as he writes. His new nonfiction book is Monsters and Marine Mysteries. Hey, Max, welcome back to Coast. How are you?
I'm great, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
Is your Siberian forest cat in close proximity right now?
Actually, after the last experience, and there's actually two of them now, not one.
So oh, that's they, right.
Yes, we got the younger brother now, so there's two of these behemoths. But no, they're both outside my office lurking around out there, probably lounging, hoping for a late-night snack, you know, that kind of thing.
Are they good mousers?
They are fantastic. I mean, we don't have any mice, but they're in the wild. They're an arboreal species of cat in Russia. They actually snatch birds out of the air and climb trees to do it. So I've seen them jump up in the air and take a fly that was foolish enough to get into the house 3 or 4 feet up and snatch them right out of the air. It's pretty cool.
Wow. Wow.
And they're big cats. I mean, they're used to 20-pound cats.
Fluff, yeah, fluff. Yeah.
They're something to see. People are like, whoa.
I tell you, if I weren't allergic, I might get me a couple of those Siberian forest cats. I love big cats.
Well, actually, the paler colored ones, these ones, the lynx points and stuff, they're hyperallergenic. So believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah, oh. My wife is highly allergic to cats. But she has no problems with them.
Well, that is good to know. Mm-hmm. You are the bearer of good news, sir. Thank you. Let me ask you, and not in jest, do you prefer swimming in the ocean, in a lake, or a pool?
Well, I grew up with Jaws like you did. I was afraid to take a bath. Or maybe I should.
That bad, eh?
Oh, it was pretty bad. Yeah, I was expecting this thing to somehow come up out of the pipe, you know, on the second floor. But I'm more of a pool swimmer. I'll swim freshwater. I've done a lot of snorkeling and scuba and snooba and all that stuff, given the subject matter that I specialize in. Of course, I'm inherently paranoid. So yeah, the last time we were in Hawaii, for example, I was in like 70 feet of water, and I look down, and I see this huge fish down in, near the bottom. I'm up top. And I'm looking at him like, it's not a shark. It must have been like a giant trevally or something, but it was bigger than me. It was quite impressive. You know, see,
right,
you keep
right.
Eyes down.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Look down. Always be looking down. So with the Kronos Rising series, this leviathan of the deep that is terrifying these coastal villages and devouring people. Is it based on an actual creature that is in the fossil record?
Oh, yes. Pliosaurs were real animals. They were like the great whales of their day, you'd say. It's pretty easy to describe, to give somebody a general picture. One, if you looked at, picture an enormous crocodile, but the tail would be short, almost stubby, and four large flippers, because they are a type of plesiosaur. So they had these four large flippers that let them swim very quickly through the water. And that's what you were dealing with. So if you picture one the size of a whale, it's far more formidable because it's got a much larger skull. It has the jaw power, the bite force of a crocodile. And most people know that the saltwater crocodile has the highest bite force on the planet of excellent animals that have been tested. So this thing was a large, fast macro predator that took down pretty much anything it wanted to. I mean, there were various species, but the big ones, the big apex predators, they were the top of the food chain.
And they supposedly died out about 65 million years ago, right?
According to the fossil record, they died out about 90 million years ago. And then mosasaurs filled the ecological niche where they used to be. In my novels, I took the artistic liberty of having an additional species that hung on until the Cretaceous extinction, the Kanky impact, et cetera. Well, that's not impossible. I mean, we haven't, only 3% of known species have ever been discovered in the fossil record. So there could have been them up to that point. But they're, as far as everybody knows, they're gone.
So as far as anybody knows, in the Kronos Rising series, the last one, I guess, is a prologue to the whole series called Kronos Rising Diablo. And in that, I think it's in this one that you take a great deal of care and time sort of explaining how such a creature could have existed through all these cataclysmic events and extinction events. So can you explain how such a creature could have survived an asteroid impact or whatever?
Well, when I was putting together the basic story for Kronos Rising, I mean, the thing that inspired me to write it was my theory about or developing this sort of, like you said, cataclysmic event that could allow these animals to survive to the present. If you look at historically in fiction works, everything from the monster movies of the 50s, for example, to books from then to the now and even beyond, and there's been all these different explanations for how something extinct could have survived to the present. We've seen everything from them living in the ocean abyss, like in the book Megalodon by Robin Brown. You know, he had megalodon sharks living way, way down deep and somehow adapting to the deep water. Then we had the deadly mantis was frozen in an iceberg, the beast in 20,000 fathoms, all this different stuff. I wanted something that was believable. And I was inspired by the Willamy pines from Australia, which is a species of plant that's been around since the Jurassic. And they managed to exist in this, like, hidden little valley that was shielded from climate change, the elements, ice ages and all that stuff, and enabled these 150-million-year-old trees to survive to the present. Unfortunately, there was no Jurassic creatures living with them, but the plants themselves did. So my theory was that when the asteroid struck that wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs 65 or 66 million years ago, one of the side effects that was caused by this devastating impact were mega tsunamis 1,000 meters tall. So if you picture the Sears Tower in Chicago and picture something more than twice that height, a wave, it would go, who knows, maybe 100 miles inland. The devastation on top of everything else of a burning and world, it is Armageddon. And so what I worked it out is I had this, invented this fictitious caldera, which would eventually be called Diablo Caldera off the coast of Cuba. And I had it where a lot of these marine predators were out and about. It was actually a mating chase in the story. And it's all detailed in the Cretaceous flashbacks even of the first Kronos Rising book, but the tsunami sweeps them up. And an entire ecosystem with them, of course, because you're talking cubic miles of ocean are being elevated, and it crashes into and swamps this caldera, which the wave is much bigger than the caldera as it goes over it by height. And as it does so, it fills this caldera with salt water, instantly creating a gigantic 8-mile-wide saltwater aquarium. So these animals, this entire food web, from plankton to tiny fish, cephalopods, the larger ones, all the way up to a few surviving stragglers, specimens of this pliosaur species called Kronosaurus imperator, are now imprisoned inside of this caldera, the fishbowl theory, we'll call it. Okay? And now around them, the world is still going to hell in a handbasket. And after all the rest of the devastation from the molten stuff falling from the sky and the burning ash and all this other stuff and the earthquakes, et cetera, even after all that dies down, you have what's called an impact winter. And all that debris from the asteroid itself, from the Earth that was thrown up into the sky, blots out the sun for months. I mean, ranges estimate whether it was 2 months or 6 months. Some people have thought years. But your food web is completely interrupted. Photosynthesis stops. The planet freezes. The oceans most likely froze 6 feet thick throughout a good portion of the planet. So in order for these animals to survive, the water they were in obviously could not freeze. They could not freeze to death. They're reptiles. They needed some sort of heat source. But when you have a geothermal system like a semi-extinct volcano, a.k.a. a volcanic caldera, it worked it out that way. I developed it so that this kept these animals in at least a tepid environment where they could be semi-comfortable and survive this impact winter and periodic ice ages over the millennia until we got to the present, at which point then obviously a crack developed in the side of this caldera and it split open temporarily and some of what was in there escaped. And not just one of these pliosaurs, but some proto-squid that were the size of a minibus, a species of fish called Ziphactinus, which is also called the bulldog fish, which is a great white shark size, looked like a tarpon with fangs the size of a great white, and a bunch of other stuff. And I let all these animals out into the oceans, and they did what any other creature is going to do, any other invasive species, and they had the advantage, size, strength, speed, ferocity, fearing nothing. And they multiplied until they became a huge ecological problem for we, the dominant species on the planet. And these animals got to the point where they had almost taken over the oceans of the world. So which
I guess what right mm-hmm. what disturbs me is if you can imagine it's possible.
Yeah, that's the scariest part. I would see the reviews and the comments on social media. People really loved the book because they were saying you made it so believable. You know, we call it achieving a suspension of disbelief. That when people read it, it wasn't just a realistic and exciting, scary story, but that people believe this could actually happen. Are they out there? Are these things still alive? Is that what happened to, you know, Shark Alpha off the coast of Australia in the Bremer Canyon years ago? You know, the super predator, et cetera. Now, what are these sightings? What are these creatures?
And then we have Monsters and Marine Mysteries, where you're actually presenting some eyewitness accounts, pretty harrowing eyewitness accounts here. And, you know, it's disturbing because, again, these are true stories. These are credible witnesses, at least as far as I can tell, you know, after reading. They sound very believable. Why would someone, you know, make up these stories? I asked you this before. We're going to head into a break shortly here. I asked you this once before, and that is, you know, whether you're a hockey fan, because the newest entry into the National Hockey League, they'll start next season, is a team called the Seattle Kraken. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, you know, Max should be going to those games. I mean, are you a hockey fan?
I am. I was more a hockey fan when I was a kid in Philadelphia, you know, when the Flyers were, like, in their heyday, shall we say. You know, Bobby Orr and all those guys. But, you know, it's, Seattle's a bit far for me to be, you know, schlepping out.
Right, of course. But you could follow him on TV. But yeah, it's exactly. As soon as I saw the name, I thought of Max Hawthorne. But I know someone who's married to a Greek. I know what Kraken is from the Greek mythology, and it's, you know, it was this monster that was created by Poseidon. But that's not the kind of Kraken that they're talking about in Seattle. Kraken has another meaning, doesn't it?
Well, the actual word Kraken or Krake, this is an old German term. It means octopus, which is why the Kraken that I utilized in the Cronus Rising series are a species of immense deep water octopus that I kind of built up for the story. And actually, according to one witness that is in the book, they actually saw one of these octopi. So, but yeah, that's what the word actually means. Now, the typical interpretation of Kraken is people assume that it's Architeuthis, the giant squid, or the colossal squid, or something like that. But the word itself does mean octopus, and there have been, besides sightings of incredibly large squid, there have been sightings of incredibly large octopuses over the centuries.
We'll talk about that when we come back, because that's frightening, because octopi are so incredibly smart. This is very disturbing. We'll come back and discuss further. Max Hawthorne stays with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. If someone says dire wolf, most people will imagine the creatures belonging to the Stark family in Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. For the HBO series, northern Inuit dogs were used to portray these giant creatures, but Martin didn't make up direwolves for his novels. They actually existed. The direwolf was a canid species that lived in the Pleistocene era and became extinct 13,000 years ago. They were top predators, along with the giant cats that lived at the same time. Because of their size and back teeth, strong enough to crack bone, dire wolves could bring down megafauna such as Ice Age horses and ground sloths. You can read more about dire wolves in the news section of it, coasttocoastam.com. Back to more of my conversation with Max Hawthorne, the award-winning author of the Kronos Rising novel series and his new one, A True Account, Monsters and Marine Mysteries, right here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Max, before the break, we were talking about octopus, which I prefer grilled with some chilled white wine. But these things are enormous. They can be enormous, right? There are accounts of giant octopus. How big can they get?
Well, the accepted norm for the giant Pacific octopus is usually 20-something feet in length, which is a sizable octopus. The persons that I interviewed for Monsters and Marine Mysteries, of course, the thing that they saw was not a normal octopus. I mean, it was insanely large, let's put it that way. It's not that far down the road, I mean, in terms of time-wise or anything like that. This happened, I believe, in 2013 or something. I'd have to check my notes. But I spoke to a gentleman named Demetrius. He and three of his friends had been down by Sanibel Island in Florida, which is interesting in terms of there's been a lot of sightings in that area of assorted strange things. And they had rented a charter boat. The captain was taking them out on like a 55-foot boat. And they were a few miles offshore and kind of drifting along while they were fishing. And they were using what Demetrius described as incredibly smelly bait. I don't know if it was chunks of you know, fish that it might have gone a little bad or just fresh. It just, you know, stank. I mean, he's not a fisherman, I could tell, but they were bait fishing along, and I assume that the smells the boat gave off, the fact that the boat was just drifting along like a sleeping whale, in my opinion, and the combined scent of the raw fish and blood in the water brought this thing to the surface. He said they were all sitting there, standing there, fishing, holding their rods, and then a piece of tentacle, and when I say a piece, meaning like they only saw part of the tentacle, 30 feet in length, just comes up to the surface of the water from the depths and starts snaking its way toward their boat. They're standing 20 feet from this as it happens, and he described it in full detail, reddish-brown color, smooth, white underneath, you know, they could see the suckers, and the thick tentacle got as thick as a yard at the far end of it, furthest from them. Now, if you picture a tentacle 3 feet thick, that's an incredibly large animal, because even a really big octopus would have tentacles that are only 6 inches thick, maybe 8 inches thick on a really big one. I'm spitballing it, but, you know, at most a foot. This was three times that size, and they were only seeing 30 feet of what was obviously a much larger tentacle. It came to the side of their boat, and it starts feeling along the side of the boat, touching the boat, you know, like. And he thought it was normal. They assumed octopuses all got that big. I, of course, laughed when he told me the story, because that is not true, obviously. And they thought the creature was curious. It, after a minute or two of doing this, it withdrew, and it snaked back, went dead deep down, and the animal began to move off. They were standing there, and he said that they saw the rest of the tentacles. There were other tentacles below the surface, a bunch of them, obviously, I'm assuming there were eight, like any other octopus. And they saw the outline and silhouette of what must have been its body. And they said that they estimated this thing was 80 or 90 feet in length from man.
Oh, my Lord.
Right. I mean, that's you know, an impossibly huge cephalopod. And, you know, the amusing or scary part of this, and what, and by the way, I'll take one thing is, they when they got to shore, they went to the library. These are older guys, so they're old school, as we say. They like pick up physical books and research. And they got pictures of all different cephalopod arms and tentacles, et cetera, and they all universally agreed that it was definitely an octopus's arm that they saw. They also called either the harbor master or the Coast Guard. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think it was the harbor master. And they reported it. They said this gigantic octopus was, like, you know, exploring our boat. And the guy on the phone said to them, oh, yeah, we know. It's been around for a few days now. You know, this type of stuff. And I'm like, that's all he said? Did they do anything? Did they tell people? I mean, this is a big animal, and they're carnivores, you know?
Right, but, right.
You know, I mean, so the thing is that what Demetrius didn't realize is, besides the fact that he thought all octopuses are the size of two school buses put together, is that there are chemoreceptors in the suckers of octopuses. That's like taste buds. So they can hold something and they can analyze it by taste, by texture, and everything else. They know what it is, just using their suckers. So this creature, from the description, sounds like it was exploring their boat and checking to see if it was a living thing. I imagine it wanted to see if it was a sleeping whale or a dead whale, looks like it's sleeping. And if it had decided that this 55-foot boat was a whale, it probably would have pounced on it, you know, wrapped its arms around it, tried to drag it on it, tried to feed on it, etc. I'm
Holy
sure at that
smokes.
Point realized, yeah. Can you imagine the scene? I mean, like, you know, this is a big animal. It, you know, big enough to take a boat like that under. And, of course, it would have realized that it was fiberglass and what, you know, let go. But God forbid if it had latched onto a person or one of them fell in the water while this was happening, you know, it might have turned around and said, well, this isn't edible, but here, I've got an hors d'oeuvre, you know, hey, wait. Maybe there's more on here. Let me start exploring, you know, and start feeling around for other morsels.
Right. And these things are smart, right? I mean, I've seen documentaries on octopi. Yeah. They're almost like from a different planet. They're so alien and so smart.
There are some theories that I've seen scientists put out where they said the DNA is so unlike everything else that's typical for the planet. They're almost wondering here, like, somehow eggs or something on a meteor or something like that many years ago and just settled into the planet. But yes, they are highly intelligent. Their brains are proportionately larger than those of many mammal species. And that's only the actual brain that's in the mantle. Two-thirds of their neurons are in their arms. And what's fascinating about an octopus is its arms are actually able to act independently of the rest of the animal. It can given a pair of its arms a command, and then focus on other tasks. So let's say it was gripping like one of those jars and they test it where they put a crab inside, and they want to see how long it'll take the octopus to take the lid off and get the crab out and stuff. It could assign three arms, they really are called arms, and to do that, and it could play chess or, you know, watch TV or whatever. It'd be like, you know, you writing a paper while watching a cable program or something. So they are highly intelligent problem solvers and capable of so much more than people know.
And now that's a super predator. When you've got that kind of brawn and brains, and where there's one, there's more. That's, again, the disturbing part.
Yeah, I expressed a theory in Monsters and Marine Mysteries that I felt like there have been many reports in the past of 50-foot octopuses off of the Hawaiian Islands. And they always seem to, their appearance seems to coincide with when the green sea turtles come into nests. You know, these big 600-pound turtles come ashore, lay their eggs, and come back. And if you're thinking about, you know, a very large cephalopod like that, it needs a large meal. And a 600-pound turtle, which is really not able to fight back much against a predator that size, would be a great meal. So logic indicates, you know, they follow where the food is. And in Florida, around Sanibel, et cetera, you know, the Florida manatee is much bigger. It could weigh 1,000 or 1,200 pounds or more. I'd have to check my notes. And they're also defenseless. They're like a big, fat, swimming cheeseburger or something. And so it seems like some of these sightings and some of the things that have happened, and another incident in Sanibel that I documented for the book, indicate that it's possible these creatures could be there to prey on manatees, which would once again make sense. You know, predators follow their prey. So
the shark could be the least of our worries. The illustration on the cover of Monsters and Marine Mysteries, I don't know, is that a woodcut originally? Describe.
I think it's from the 1800s or even earlier. It looks like it's hard to tell if it's a squid or an octopus, but it's attacking a sailing ship and dragging under it. And I don't know if that's related to the Pearl incident or not. That was from the 1800s. I'd have to, again, not all my notes in front of me, but you know, when you do a book like this, you have oodles. 1874, just pulled it up right here. But that happened back in the Bay of Bengal in India, and a 150-foot schooner, which is a sailing ship like that one there, in the bay, sights what turns out to be a gigantic squid. They start shooting at it with their guns. The squid attacks the schooner, smashes into it, wraps it up with its arms, pulls it over onto its side, and sinks it, killing a good percentage of the people on board in the process. And the squid was described as being even bigger than the schooner. So you're talking a cephalopod of colossal size and strength.
Took down a 150-foot schooner, dragged it beneath the waves, and killing most of the crew.
Yeah, they were shooting at it, chopping at it with cutlasses and everything like that. There was nothing they could do. I mean, that's why you don't go shooting at it. You see a 150-foot squid swimming along, you just leave them be, and, you know, you do your thing. But, yeah, there was all the people on board, the survivors, all issued statements that were turned into the police, et cetera. I included all of it in the book. I mean, this is 150 years ago, obviously, but there's several incidents like that where ships were attacked by these things and stuff. So, you know, you see an incident like Demetrius and his friend's experience. This animal was, in my opinion, octopi are more intelligent than squid. I believe they have proportionally larger brains. The fact that they camouflage more, that they use chromatophores to change the color, their texture, and everything else like that of their bodies, they're incredible masters of this. And the ability to do that, that alone requires a very large brain. I think they're also more inherently cautious, whereas a squid will just, you know, just come after something. Like in the book, there's an incident where a yacht, like a trimaran, like a sailing yacht, was attacked by a giant squid maybe 10 years ago. And it stopped the yacht by hanging onto it and trying to pull it under. Mistaken identity. It probably thought it was a whale. But, you know, they just come at you much more aggressively. Humboldt squids, everything else. I think an octopus is a little more cunning, a little more cautious. You know, it takes its time. It stalks things.
Right. And so I think it's the sperm whale that will dive deep down and hunt squid. But these squids are big enough to hunt whales, right?
Well, there are a bunch of anecdotal reports, which I document, and there were a lot more I didn't include, because you could do a whole book just on incidents like that, but a lot of them go back to the days of sailing ships, when I think these things were more apt to be on the surface. You didn't have noisy ships the size of, you know, small towns bearing down on creatures and stuff like that, with their engines blasting and props the size of my living room. But there were many incidents where whalers and such saw what they thought were sea serpents wrestling with whales and pulling whales under to their death and stuff. But if you look at the descriptions and the drawings they did, it becomes obvious that it's not a serpent. It's the tentacles of an immense squid latching onto a whale and dragging it under. And a lot of people will see this and say, oh, well, it was just a sperm whale was feeding on a squid and they were at the surface. But there are incidents where, number one, the squid is larger than the whale considerably. So sperm whales will not go after a squid that's bigger than them. Or, you know, I mean, they can only eat what they can swallow in one piece. And they could never swallow something that big that would prey on them. And there were incidents even where humpbacks were taken by these things. A humpback is not going to be hunting a squid. So it doesn't make sense. It indicates that there are macro predatory squid out there that just get so much bigger than people think. Just because we're not seeing something that lives thousands of feet down in the blackness of the abyss doesn't mean anything. I mean, nobody saw live footage of a giant squid until, what, 10 years ago? They finally got something? No? And even then, it was only a 5-meter specimen. So, you know, that doesn't mean anything. The oceans are practically endless.
I'm going to enjoy my calamari, my squid, down in Greektown. Without reservation, I'm going to enjoy my octopodi, as we say in Greek, without reservation, because if we don't eat them, they're just going to eat us, folks. we're coming up on a break here, but I want to just get into this now, and we'll continue after the break. But you're coming up to Vancouver, I think, or you've been up here again to meet somebody who had an encounter off the coast of British Columbia with a very, very large creature. Tell me about that.
This is the Gary LaMotta turtle, I think we're talking about. Is that right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, cool. Gary and a friend of his had an incident back in, I think it was 1969. And they encountered a monstrous unknown species of sea turtle that was either feeding or frolicking around Vancouver Island. And I'll see if I can remember all this off the top of my head, but they had, I interviewed Earl. Earl was Gary's friend, and there had been some confusion in past entries of cryptozoological research organizations and such. They, I guess, didn't get all the details or things get, you know, messed up along the way, but they thought that Earl worked for Gary, like as an employee on his boat or something, like a first mate or something like that, and that they were together on the boat when this happened. And what it actually happened is they had two different boats. They were friends. They were fishermen. They had these 38-foot like cabin cruisers, and Gary had gone out earlier. Like, he was out first, a mile or two ahead of his friend, and they would talk on the radio. And Gary had a Super 8 camera, a film camera, which I remember as a kid even having one. It was like the iPhone of its day, let's say. Not exactly advanced technology by today's standards, but Gary was a real nut when it came to filming stuff. He had thousands, as his family had revealed, of, you know, rolls of film he'd shot of everything from, I guess, pets to friends to family, fishing trips or whatever. And so what Earl told me is, I got to interview him, is that, because Gary passed away years ago, fortunately, but all of a sudden his friend starts calling him, freaking out on the walkie-talkie, and he's like, Earl, he's like, get over here. He's like, what? He goes, there's a sea monster. A sea monster. He's laughing. He goes, I'm telling you, there's a sea monster. Get here now. Hurry up. You know? So Earl, like, guns it, and he's getting out there as fast as he can. His boats aren't super fast, but he gets there in, I don't know, 5 or 10 minutes or something like that, at which point this thing has now, before, it was on the surface, and it was sticking its head up, and it was looking at Gary, you know, and he got this film.
Max, I'm going to jump in here. Pardon the interruption. This is a classic cliffhanger. We're going to take a timeout, come back, and continue to talk about this enormous sea turtle. Max Hawthorne stays with us. Monsters and Marine Mysteries, right here on Coast to Coast AM.